I'm Bob Crawford, and as always, joined by Dr. Ben Sawyer. Ben, we made a new best friend this week.
Yes, we did. Yes, we did. We're always making new best friends, and they keep getting better.
When you're interviewing a historian and they mention Mark Cheatham's name in high regard, not knowing that you know Mark Cheatham and you love Mark Cheatham, and there's this mutual respect going on, you just know, I want to hang out with this guy as much as possible. I may move to Nebraska so I can hang out with Don Hickey.
Hang out to Don Hickey on the campus of Wayne State College, where he is a professor of history, an expert on the War of 1812. And his Mark Cheatham story is great. And as you'll hear, it speaks to the value of making sure that what you write is reviewed by other experts, because even the most rigorous researchers, we miss things sometimes.
You know, Don Hickey is, today's episode's about the War of 1812. And the New Yorker called Don Hickey the dean of 1812 historians.
His book, The War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict, was recently published in a second updated edition for the bicentennial of the War of 1812. He has written some amazing things, and he really, this war, and if you're thinking right now, the War of 1812, we don't know much about it. Yeah, that's the point. It's the War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict, but there's so much value in it. It's a war that makes Andrew Jackson a hero. It's a war that brings down the political party of Alexander Hamilton. The Federalist Party falls apart, and we pick a fight with the British, and the White House is burned, and we invade Canada for a second time.
And the Star-Spangled Banner comes out of the War of 1812, and the legend of Dolly Madison saving the painting of George Washington as the White House is about to be burned by the British. Yeah, so much of American culture was cemented as a result of that conflict, a conflict that we'll learn was highly contested in the United States.
Right, one of the least popular wars to have been fought.
And Ben, what did they call the War of 1812 and 1812?
The current, what is it, the late war?
Stick around and we'll find out.
Stick around and we'll find out. And thank you guys for listening.
Ramza Records' David Childers reteams with producer Don Dixon for Run Skeleton Run. The lauded North Carolina singer-songwriter's latest effort features vocals and banjo contributions by Scott Avett of the Avett Brothers. Road to Now listeners can even get a 20% off discount on David Childers' new album by using the promo code HISTORY at RamzaRecords.com.
Don Hickey, welcome to the Road to Now.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Well, I just wanted to start off. We are here. It is January 8th is the 203rd anniversary of the Battle of New Orleans. Your book, which is one of the, if not the book on the War of 1812, it's entitled The War of 1812, A Forgotten Conflict. It was recently republished for the Bicentennial Edition in 2015.
And revised.
Yes, it's a wonderful book. So I want to ask you, why do you think the conflict has been forgotten? And how can remembering it help us understand the world we live in today?
That's a great question. And I've pondered that. Why is this a forgotten conflict? And it seems to me there are a whole sort of host of things that have contributed to that. Number one, the causes are obscure. It was a war fought for neutral rights, British encroachments on our rights on the high seas, and nobody goes to war over neutral rights nowadays. So the causes are obscure. And then the strategy is confusing. Why did we invade Canada to secure a redress of maritime issues? The outcome is unclear. It's still under debate who won this war. That everybody's happy with the outcome. Americans are happy because they think they won. Canadians are happier because they know they won. And the British are happiest of all because they've forgotten all about the war. And except for the Indians, who are the biggest losers, that actually is a fairly accurate assessment of the outcome of the war. And then there's more. The war looked more to the past than to the future. It looks like the last of the North American colonial wars. There's the impact of the Civil War, which tended to push all earlier wars deep into the recesses of our public memory, except the American Revolution. And then there's finally the name of the war itself, which is not very informative.
You know, this may be a silly question, but our producer brought it up and I thought about it. I was like, that is a good question. What did they call the War of 1812 and 1812?
Well, that's a great question. The term actually first appeared in the title of a newspaper article published in New York about 3 months after the declaration of war. And then it all but disappeared for several years. For the next 30-odd years, while it was being waged, it was the war, or the present war, or occasionally the current war. And then after it was over, it was the late war, or sometimes the late war with Great Britain. However, that wasn't going to work once the Mexican War broke out in 1846. And it is in the late 40s that the name, the War of 1812, sort of comes into general use in the United States, although that name isn't embraced in Canada until the 1890s and in Great Britain until recently the bicentennial was sort of commemorated there.
So the Canadians just called it the second time America tried to annex us?
Not exactly. I think prior to the 1890s, the Canadians, like their British cousins, called it the late war with America, the second Anglo-American war, the second war with America. They had a number of sort of terms that indicated this was the second war fought between the United States and Great Britain.
And it was also called by some opponents at the time, it was called Mr. Madison's War after the president, James Madison. Why was that? Why was that a term?
Well, that was an attempt of the New England Federalist Party to pin this war and all of its ills on the president. But it didn't really catch on because Madison was not a very strong war leader. He had a great respect for the civil liberties of his domestic opponents and tolerated backbiting and even opposition and disloyalty in his own cabinet and did not provide that kind of forceful leadership that so many American presidents have done in time of war.
Yeah, one of the things that I found fascinating in your book was how divisive in the American consciousness this war was. I think you argue that it was the most divisive war internally we've ever fought.
Well, yeah, certainly on the basis of the party division. The Federalist Party voted unanimously against the war, and about 80% of the Republicans in Congress voted for it. Most of the Republicans, after the decision was made, fell into line, but the Federalists remained in opposition pretty much throughout the war. So it is the most divisive party war in our history, although you might argue that Vietnam or maybe one of the Middle Eastern wars in a broader sense has created deeper divisions in the nation.
You do point out that there were two exceptions for the deep divisions, the summer of 1812 and the fall of 1814. What happened in those two periods of time?
Well, Federalists outside of New England were sort of puzzled by what to do when war was declared. And some thought, well, maybe we ought to support it or at least remain neutral. The New England Federalists were adamant, though. As one Massachusetts Federalist said, this is like any other bad law. You have to obey it, but you can oppose it and try to bring it to a speedy end by your opposition. And then there were some other things that the administration did in the summer of 1812 that tended to drive Federalists from the middle and southern states into New England's camp. And probably the most important of these was the Baltimore riots, in which a number of Federalists were beaten and tortured, and several were even killed. And that sort of suggested to many Federalists that this war was not for free trade and sailors' rights, but rather to silence the opposition and to promote the interest of the Jeffersonian Republican Party that was then in power. In late 1814, it looked like, because the war in Europe had ended and the British were diverting military and naval assets to the American war, that this had become strictly a defensive war. And so that led to some second thoughts among Federalists in the middle of the southern states. But again, New England was adamant, and again, the administration did some things that tended to alienate those middle and southern state federal. They would take no Federalists into the cabinet, and they continued to talk about conquering Canada and driving the British out of North America. And they talked about adopting a conscription law, which would have been very unpopular among Federalists.
Oh, for sure. And I think this is interesting because we're in a time now where we talk about political division being at a high point, but it sounds like the War of 1812 is another one of those times in American history where we see pretty clear, as you just said, people literally being beaten down in the streets in Baltimore for their political views.
Yeah, it seems to me, I do find this somewhat reassuring. What we're seeing today is maybe one of five different occasions when domestic political passions were really divisive. And the only time it led to big trouble was in 1860 when we ended up with a civil war.
How did the war change James Madison? How did it change his presidency? Like when he came into office, he was a Jeffersonian, right? He was small government guy. He was against the Bank of the United States. What realities did he face when he became president and through the war that made him have to fundamentally change his ideology?
Well, I don't think it did change his ideology. He remained very much a believer in small government. The one big change that he made along with other Republicans was the decision after the war was over to maintain a sizable military establishment. The war really marked the birth of the modern military establishment and this notion that even in time of peace, we have to be prepared for war. That was the biggest change, I think, in Madison's outlook.
The reason that he might have wanted to build some type of a standing army has to do with the fairly swift blows that the British level against the United States in 1814. When I teach this war, I say when we declare war in 1812, Great Britain is fighting Napoleon. And I say this would be the equivalent of me starting a fight with Roy Mayweather Jr. while he's fighting Manny Pacquiao. I can get some blows in really fast, and it's easy for me to start that fight as long as he's fighting Manny Pacquiao. But the minute that Manny Pacquiao's done, Floyd Mayweather's going to whip me. So could you explain what happens in 1814 when finally Napoleon is fallen and the British can turn around and finally turn on us?
Well, let's go back to 1812 to begin with. The fact that we were unprepared for this war meant that we enjoyed virtually no success despite all the advantages that we should have enjoyed early in the war, because Canada was vulnerable, and the British were tied up in Europe. And I think that was the first sort of experience that opened the eyes to the need to have a peacetime military establishment. Now, what actually happened in 1814 was the British launched a number of invasions at different points around the United States. Most of them failed. It was just real tough to wage offensive war. And I think it was the experience of the entire war rather than simply 1814 that demonstrated that you really needed to be ready for war in time of peace. Otherwise, you're going to be in a terrible fix for the first year or two while you build up your military establishment.
Right. And that terrible fix led to a pretty devastating treatment of Washington, D.C.?
Well, the British did indeed occupy Washington, D.C., and they burned the public buildings. And that was undoubtedly the low point for the United States in the war. But the U.S. enjoyed considerable success in New York when it won the Battle of Lake Champlain, forcing the British to withdraw from upstate New York. They were also defeated in the Chesapeake when they were unable to silence the guns of Fort McHenry and thus they had to give up their attack on Baltimore. And the United States enjoyed considerable success, too, on the Niagara front in some of the biggest and bloodiest battles of the war, which took place in the summer and fall of 1814. So it was not all a matter of the British because they were able to build up their forces, enjoying success in the American war. The bottom line was, it was tough to face to wage offensive war in the North American wilderness. And the defending side always had a huge advantage.
you know, the War of 1812, it may not be the most well-known war in American history, but it does lend itself well to folklore and these great tales, right? With Dolly Madison saving the portrait of George Washington as the British were about to burn the White House. Also, the Star-Spangled Banner is written during the war. And the legend is set in stone for Andrew Jackson. Can you talk about Jackson through the war and how he comes out of the war a national hero?
Okay, well, more broadly, what you're describing is the cultural legacy of the war, and it was pretty significant because we got all these great symbols and sayings, the USS Constitution, the Star-Spangled Banner, Uncle Sam comes into sort of a general use during the war, the flag earns greater respect, Kentucky Rifle wins its reputation, its inflated reputation as an iconic American weapon. And then you've got the sayings, don't give up the ship, we have met the enemy and they are ours. And even Tippecanoe and Tyler too, which was the 1840 campaign slogan that Harrison used. But you're right, Andrew Jackson sort of emerges as a huge, outsized hero. And he does very well because he seems to sort of typify post-war America with its commitment to democracy and slavery and Indian removal and expansion, some of the good and bad things in American history.
And I guess we should point out your book, Glorious Victory, Witness to History, which is about Jackson and the Battle of New Orleans.
Yeah, I zeroed in on that whole Gulf Coast campaign and how Jackson played such a seminal role there and really emerged as not simply the great hero of the war, but really the best military leader, at least on the American side of the war. The only one who could probably compare would be maybe William Henry Harrison in the Old Northwest, possibly Jacob Brown along the Niagara frontier. I think that Jackson really overshadows these guys. He did the most with the least.
Jackson wasn't a guy who was particularly well-known, right? I mean, he was a guy, people knew who he was. He had served in Congress, but he had kind of fallen, in stature because some of his antics and his dueling. How does he come to lead this major, the forces in this major battle?
Well, it starts out because he's taking part in some earlier campaigns as one of the two major generals in the Tennessee militia. And he does really well there. So eventually he gets a commission in the U.S. Army. And he does really well in the Creek War. And that sort of sets the stage for his Gulf Coast campaign that followed. But he had indeed, prior to the war, sort of not enjoyed a particularly good reputation. I mean, he was considered a violent man with a terrible temper. These were things that could serve you well as a military leader when you're trying to hold a bunch of rugged individuals together in your army, prevent them from going home or simply refusing to fight or engaging in mutiny because they're not getting any food or other supplies. And the way I put it is that his men feared him more than they feared the enemy, and that really helped him.
La Cosecha Coffee Roasters provides fresh roasted coffee grown in a sustainable manner where the farmer is given a fair price, which means the coffee goes straight from the harvest to your cup. The best part? You can get 10% off your next purchase by using the promo code RTN1010 at checkout. Visit lacosecha.com. Or follow the links at theroadtonell.com.
So let's go back to William Henry Harrison and the legend of Tippecanoe. So what solidified William Henry Harrison's esteem in the American public after the war?
Well, he negotiated a series of land cession treaties in the Old Northwest on behalf of the Jefferson administration between 1803 and 1809, and that really precipitated the Indian War in the Old Northwest, which I call Tecumseh's War, after the great Shawnee military leader who forged the military alliance that waged war against the U.S. Just now wrapping up a book on that war.
Oh, great! Because I think our listeners would really benefit from learning about Tecumseh.
Well, great military leader. His brother, known as the Prophet, had launched an Indian revitalization movement in the Old Northwest in 1805. And that really attracted a lot of Indians. And Tecumseh stepped in and forged a military and political alliance from that religious movement. And he was a very gifted and capable leader. Everybody liked and respected him. Even Harrison, his arch enemy, said if this guy had been somewhere else in some other civilization, we'd remember him as someone like Napoleon, you know, a really great military leader. And Harrison attacked the Indian center at Prophetstown in November of 1811, or at least he led an army up there, and the Indians attacked him. And that was the Battle of Tippecanoe. Now, interestingly, Harrison made his move when he knew Tecumseh was away on a recruiting mission. He won the battle, although he suffered greater casualties. But that marked the beginning of Tecumseh's war. And 7 months later, when the United States declares war against Great Britain, that war sort of blended into the War of 1812. And as a result, it really sort of gets pushed into the background by the larger, more significant Anglo-American War. And what I tried to do in my most recent book, which I'm completing right now, is to kind of bring that war to the forefront, to center stage, and insofar as I can, give it top billing in a book devoted exclusively to that war. That was the beginning of Harrison's reputation, and he continued to excel in his campaigns in the Old Northwest. He won not only the opening battle of the war, but the climactic battle at the Thames in eastern Canada in October of 1813. And I think, and there were a couple of other engagements in between when he did very well. So he emerges as the great frontier leader in the Old Northwest.
Can you talk about Henry Dearborn for a little bit?
Okay, well, he was the senior major general in the war, assigned to the sort of northeastern theater of operations, but he was past his prime, had no interest in campaigning, no interest in engaging in battle, expected to rely on subordinates, and was just one of a number of really bad generals that we were saddled with at the beginning of the war.
What other bad generals did we have?
Well, in charge, there were three on the northern frontier. The guy that Harrison replaced was William Hull. He surrendered Detroit to an Anglo-Indian force in 1812. There was a second on the New York frontier. This was a guy named Stephen Van Rensselaer, who had no military experience, but he was the ranking a militia officer in New York, and he did a bad job on the Niagara frontier in 1812. And then we had Dearborn, who didn't even want to fight on the frontier further east. These guys were all just past, they just didn't know what they were doing. And no surprise, the entire campaign of 1812 ended up in disaster for the United States.
And we were kind of at a point with our military where the great leaders of the American Revolution, they were gone. I mean, Washington's been gone, died in 1799. Alexander Hamilton was gone. John Lawrence. A lot of these great leaders, and this is really before West Point and its ascendancy, where are these folks being trained?
Well, that's a great question. Two of the three that I mentioned were heroes of the Revolution, William Hull and Henry Dearborn, and that's why they got these senior appointments. But they were past their prime and really had no taste for battle at this point in their lives. So they were trying to tap into the experience of the Revolution, but there just weren't any officers who had done well in the Revolution and could still serve the nation that many years later.
You know, speaking of heroes of the Revolution, what did Adams in New England and Jefferson in Virginia, both in retirement. What did they think of this war?
Well, Jefferson supported it. I mean, Madison was his close buddy, and he was throughout the war was sending these letters of advice to Madison, most of which he just ignored and did not respond to. So he fully supported the war. Jefferson was wrestling with another demon, though. He was growing ever more deeply into debt and trying to figure out how he could make enough money during the war in order to stay ahead of his creditors. And ultimately, he failed. And when he died in 1826, the Bank of Richmond owned him lock, stock, and barrel, and they had to sell off most of his estate to settle his debt. Adams, by this time, Adams' son had swung over to the Republican Party, and I think Adams was there too, generally supported the war, was very, very antagonistic to the New England Federalists who opposed it. So we have these two senior figures who are generally on the side of the war hawks in this contest.
And it's a great segue. John Quincy Adams, did he not participate in the Treaty of Ghent?
He did. He had been was named our minister to Russia, I think, before the war. And so he was in Europe, and he was on the peace commission that negotiated the end of the war. And I actually think he was technically the head commissioner, although he himself gave a lot of credit to Albert Gallatin, who was kind of a good influence for softening the differences between, say, Adams, the fierce New Englander, and Henry Clay, the ardent Westerner, when the interests of their constituents diverged.
And I believe Gallatin would play a role in the Jackson administration. Quite a delegation, really, if you think about that. Can you talk about, first, like, what brought us to the table?
Well, we were trying to get out of this war practically when it began. Our hope was that the British would be so shocked by our declaration of war, they would immediately make concessions on the leading maritime issues. Those were the Orders in Council, which regulated our trade with the continent, and impressment, which was the removal of seamen from American merchant vessels. Now, about the time we declared war, the British actually repealed the Orders in Council. So there's only one issue left, impressment. And we hoped the British would be willing to reach some kind of accommodation on this matter, but they weren't, because their naval power depended on the threat of impressment, and they weren't going to risk their naval power and losing the Napoleonic Wars to satisfy this second-rate power across the Atlantic. But we sent out peace feelers very early, eager to get the British to the peace table. And there was one point in early 1813 when the Russian ambassador said, look, my country will mediate an end of the war. The British wanted nothing to do with that, because Russia was an inland power without a navy and thus sympathetic to neutral rights. But the British did counter in November of 1813 and say, okay, look, we're willing to sit down with the United States and hold bilateral negotiations. And those were the negotiations that took place in the city of Ghent, which is now in Belgium, beginning in August 1814.
And what's amazing about this war, I think, is that the war itself, the settlement, you know, some people have said it was a draw, you know, more dramatic conclusions have been either side saying they perhaps won. But there's no question that this war fundamentally changes the United States in a lot of ways. And the three major ways that I'm thinking of now are, one, the rise of American nationalism; two, the fall of the Federalists and the first party system; and three, the development of American manufacturing. These are all three tremendous outcomes that you see grow over the next couple of decades. Could you talk about how the war itself and its aftermath? I guess first, let's say the Federalists. We were just talking about them. Even John Adams had abandoned them. What happens to the Federalists, and why do they fall apart after this war?
Well, the Federalists lost the election of 1800 because, however effective their leadership had been in the 1790s, they were out of sympathy with the American people on three big issues. They didn't much care about territorial expansion. They didn't much care about fostering a more egalitarian democracy, and they didn't much care about catering to the deep-seated Anglophobia that the American Revolution had unleashed in the nation. So they went into a period of decline, and what actually happened was Jefferson's embargo and the other trade restrictions, followed by the War of 1812, led to a revival of the party. The Federalists actually gained control of a number of states as a direct result of their opposition to the War of 1812. Their minorities in Congress in both houses increased because of their opposition. But once that war ended, that opposition, which might have been somewhat popular during the War of 1812, became a real liability, and the Federalist Party pretty quickly faded away. It would have faded away sooner had not Jeffersonian foreign policy given it a new lease on life.
Huh. And the Hartford Convention, this is kind of the seminal moment, right? Where the during the war, at the very end, the New England states begin hinting at perhaps leaving the Union?
Well, yeah, a little bit overblown. There was secession of sentiment in New England during the war, and really before the war, but no serious secessionist movement. That Hartford Convention had been summoned to deal with a number of issues, many of which were short-term war-related issues. But they did put forth a series of amendments to the Constitution, which they hoped would protect New England's position in the Union in the future. Nothing came of them, but there was a sort of hint that maybe if they didn't get this way, their way, and the war lingered, they might take stronger action. But I think the talk of that it was somehow part of a larger secessionist plot has been much overblown by its critics and its enemies.
You commented very early in the interview that Canada knew it won. How did Canada know it won? What did Canada get?
Well, what happened when the war began? The United States invaded Canada. That was there was a three-pronged invasion in 1812 and again in 1813. And except in the West, which was too remote to really count for much, the American campaign failed. So in the eyes of Canada, and people living in Canada, the United States tried to invade and annex Canada and failed. And that makes this war a great victory for the Canadians. And by the way, it looms a lot larger in their history and their public memory than it does in ours. It was a defining moment in their history.
Yeah, people tend to talk about wars that they won a lot more than the wars that they didn't quite win.
Yes, although in this particular case, it was a war that I think most scholars say it ended in a draw because it ended in a draw on the battlefield. But you can argue that the U.S. lost because we didn't achieve our war aims. Those maritime issues weren't even mentioned in the peace treaty. And there would have been nothing to stop the British if there had been another Anglo-French war, which thankfully there wasn't, for the British from resuming all those practices. So I think you can argue the U.S. lost the war, but in a broad sense, it vindicated the nation's sovereignty. It did earn a greater respect from Great Britain and the powers of Europe, and it certainly kind of helped forge the nation because of all of those cultural developments that I mentioned.
And it also creates what some have called a market revolution in the United States, the beginning of American manufacture. And could you talk about how does this lay it out, or do you agree or disagree with this?
Well, I think that probably overstates it. To some extent, the restrictive system and the war, by cutting off most of our trade with Great Britain, did give a boost to American manufacturing. But I think we were already committed to and always had been, to a sort of market-based kind of capitalism. And if it didn't happen before or during the war, it would have happened later. So it seems to me this was a development that was on the horizon, regardless of the war and Jeffersonian foreign policy.
You've been called the Dean of 1812 Scholarship by the New Yorker, and it's, in my opinion, it's a well-deserved title, well-earned. Over the past 10 years, we see these news personalities, Brian Kilmeade recently from Fox News recently put out a book about Andrew Jackson and the Battle of New Orleans. Bill O'Reilly has like a cottage industry of these history books. There's historical reviewers question some of their sourcing, and these guys might not really be writing these books. As a real historian, someone who's dedicated your life to the craft, what is your opinion of these guys and their books?
Well, they're ephemeral. You always get, popularizers. There was a time, really, up until recently, when journalists, and it's still sometimes the case, write good history. The best biography of Madison might still be the one by Irving Brant. I think Brant was a journalist. You had a lot of popular history, which was well-sourced and grounded. Now, these guys might not be sort of on top of their biases enough to control them, but still very good works. I consider the more recent works like this, and some of them are fine works, too. That's the beauty of history. Anybody can write it. As long as you can read your sources, you do your homework, and you know how to write, you can write good history. It's one discipline that anybody can practice. Does seem like they're these sort of quickie works that come out, and they are somewhat flawed, but they still might be largely sound. I took a quick look at that one on the Battle of New Orleans,
yeah,
by those two guys, and I went on Barnes & Noble. I couldn't read the damn thing, so I'm just sort of glancing at it. And one of the things I looked at was to see if they cited a guy named Augustus Buell in their bibliography, and they did, and they used him at least for one quote, and he was a guy who made up quotes, and he was exposed as early as the 1950s by Samuel Eliot Morison. He'd done a biography of Paul Revere. Well, Morison knew the sources, and he said Revere never said these things. This is historical fiction. I missed that, and when I wrote my own book on Jackson and New Orleans, I found a fabulous quote in Buell. I stuck it in, got into the page proofs, and I was talking to this guy, a really good Jackson scholar from Cumberland College, Mark Cheatham.
Yes!
A former guest on our podcast.
Okay. Well, he knew his stuff, and he said, well, Buell's fake, and he explained this, and I have since been trying to get him to write an article on Buell. But anyway, I'm in the page proofs, and I got this quote. So I found, I didn't want to change the footnote number, so I found another quote that worked. and I substituted in, and this was John Hopkins University Press, and I'm talking to my editor, and they're exchanging emails, and she said, well, you might be over the limit. This might cost you some money. You only get so many changes. And I said, I don't care what it costs. I'm paying the freight. I don't want a phony quote in my book. Maybe the kind of mistake you make if you're not deeply familiar with your sources. And hell, I almost made it. So in a way, I was a faker too.
Well, you know what? I asked that question because Mark Cheatham wrote a review of the Brian Kilmeade book and pointed that out. So it's great. And the fact that Mark Cheatham's a great friend of our show and a good friend of ours. And so it's great to, that anecdote you just told was worth $1 million in my opinion.
Well, it's a fun story to tell on myself.
I could also add that, that Kilmeade has been the guest to be invited to the Hermitage to give the talk on the Battle of the Battle of New Orleans, on the anniversary. So there you go.
Christ. Well, for the bicentennial, they had, W.H. Brands, who I think is a very good scholar. The guy who's written a million biographies of prominent figures.
Oh yeah. I've read his Jackson bio.
I actually asked him, what's your best-selling book? Because he was the keynote speaker at the bicentennial when I was there. And he said, Ben Franklin. I said, how many copies did you sell? And he said, 700,000. And, my jaw dropped. That's right. I thought, oh, my God. But he was the keynote speaker. And he made the comment during his talk that the British were planning, in conjunction with their Gulf Coast campaign, of sending an army from Canada down the Mississippi River. Well, that's complete and utter bullshit. And afterwards, I went up to him and I said, Bill or William or Mr. Grant, I forgot now, I guess. And I said, that's a crock of bullshit. That never happened. And I later checked, and it never did. I mean, there was some, I think it just comes from one British officer saying, you know, we could do that at some point in the war. And then it turns into this campaign that Brands thinks they're actually going to launch. And I give Brands credit, because we were sitting there after I turned to him and said, you know, that's just complete bullshit. That never happened. And he said, oh. And then some guy came up and asked him a question. He says, I think you should ask this guy your question. So I thought he took it well. And I thought, if I ever see him again, I'm going to apologize and say, well, I never really should have said anything, but you really took it well.
So what led you to American history?
Well, it's, you know, we often end up in places by accident. I liked going to school, graduated from college and thought, gee, this is fun. I'm going to continue to go to school. What's the easiest discipline? One that someone who's not, you know, a high IQ person. I can't do literary criticism. All that bullshit they see, I can't. What are you talking about? Like, I didn't say that. And mathematics, Christ, I got lost in calculus. So there were no other disciplines that were going to work for me. I said, history, I can read. I can do this. It really is a discipline that anybody can do. And so I was sort of drawn into it. And after I got my PhD, I thought, oh boy, I better write an article or two to get a job. And that's when, over the next 15 years, when I wrote a series of articles, that's when I learned my craft and when I developed my passion for writing. And that's what I've been doing ever.
That's incredible. I love your humility. I love your humility. The guy who was the dean of War of 1812 history is like, oh, wasn't that smart?
you've got to know your limitations. And I tell my students, it's not the smartest person who gets ahead. It's the guy who works hard, is determined, and is resilient when you have those setbacks.
Those are things that cannot be bought. They're just part of, they got to be in your bread, and you got to figure it out yourself.
Yeah, I think you're probably right.
Well, Don Hickey, Dean of 1812 Scholarship and my new best friend, thank you for being here. It has been a wonderful to spend this time with you today.
Well, this has been great fun for me, and I appreciate this. I did a ton during the bicentennial, but, you know, the market for 1812 scholars has sort of fallen off since then. So I'm delighted to do this. And just a reminder, I've got a book that I'm completing on Tecumseh's War, and if you want to do this again after that book comes out, I'd be delighted to talk to you guys again.
Absolutely. We would love to. We love guys like you and Cheatham. Like, we like to think that we're all of the same cloth. So you can come back anytime for any book, for any reason. We'd love to have you.
Great. And if you see Cheatham before I do, say hello.
Absolutely.
Thank you for listening. The Road to Now is hosted by Bob Crawford and Benjamin Sawyer and produced by Bob Crawford, Ben Sawyer, and Ian Scotta. Our associate editor is Megan Summers. Today's music is by Paul Autofiglia. We'd like to say a special thanks to our supporters on Patreon, with a special shout out to our Washingtonians: Eric King, Tanya Marsh, Mary Hawking, Paul Ayler, Tim and Caitlin Wells, Christopher Willis, Peggy Donica, Fig White, and Jeff LeCain. If you like what you're hearing, please take a minute and rate us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you get The Road to Now. It only takes a second, and it does a lot to help us spread the word. For Bob Crawford, this is Dr. Benjamin Sawyer. Take care.